Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking about the environment under the Trump administration, the climate inside the Democratic Party, and efforts to expose U.S. government spying on Occupy activists. But before we can move on, a U.S. district judge has ruled that a number of U.S. intelligence agencies need to immediately release any information regarding whether or not they spied on activists involved in Occupy Philadelphia in 2011. The judge ruled that the case, stemming originally from a 2014 Freedom of Information Act request, required the FBI, CIA, and NSA to turn over all documents related to this potential spying and reveal whether or not it had been taking place. This case could be yet another important exposure to the fact that U.S. authorities were and probably continue to be significantly surveilling activists and organizers associated with progressive movements, in this case the Occupy movement, which it clearly viewed as a political threat. The Department of Homeland Security, for instance, operates a national network of so-called fusion centers that act as hubs for law enforcement at all levels to collaborate, coordinate, and share information. In one case, a working group of police chiefs in major cities formed a committee to study, quote-unquote, emerging threats. And the very first issue they decided to work on was the Occupy movement. They then worked with the DHS Fusion Center to produce a bulletin released to fusion centers across the country and duly disseminated, of course, up and down the chain of law enforcement with intelligence these local police agencies had gathered on Occupy. In Boston, the regional fusion center actually produced twice daily bulletins on Occupy protesters. It monitored all their social media and many of the movements and activities even vaguely related to Occupy, including labor organizing by Verizon workers and political meetings on workers' rights issues on college campuses, with detailed lists not just of people attending but also speakers at such events, which of course were totally peaceful and well within the constitutional rights of the participants to engage in. Documents related to this fusion center spying also revealed that the Department of Defense was also spying on Occupy. For instance, the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, or DTRA, was using fusion centers to share information gathered with law enforcement. What is the DTRA, you may ask? Well, their self-described mission is to, quote, address the entire spectrum of chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and high-yield explosive threats, end quote. I.e., this is the unit that is designed to deal with weapons of mass destruction, and yet here they are, spying on Occupy protesters. And what were some of the threats that these people were so worried about in the Department of Defense? Well, one was a, quote, national prayer vigil with unemployed folks and faith leaders, end quote. Yep, clearly a WMD-level event. One other major issue involving federal law enforcement and Occupy was their monitoring of holiday shopping boycotts. Through the fusion centers, DHS distributed a 30-page report by an association of shopping centers on the Occupy movement. So real authority there. The Joint Terrorism Task Force director at the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C. asked for a one-page summary of this report he could circulate about these, quote, potential threats, end quote. One, quote, specific known threat, this is what they're calling a threat now, included leafleting designed to draw attention to the Occupy encampment in Seattle and a teach-in at Occupy Bee Cave, Texas, aimed at educating people how military spending affected the economy. Again, these things were listed as threats to justify this surveillance. Interestingly, and perhaps not surprisingly, the DHS was also monitoring the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, who was able to procure and release these documents via legal action and produce reports on their other activities and campaigns, those of the PCJF. They certainly had the right to be worried about more coming out, though, because it did. The Partnership for Civil Justice Fund released further documents showing that the FBI was also spying on Occupy. FBI officials were meeting with major banks and sharing intel, operating a multi-campus network of intelligence operatives on college campuses to monitor Occupy protesters. And these same documents showed that a, quote, strategic partnership between the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and the private sector, end quote, discussed Occupy and referred to these protests as, quote, unquote, criminal activity. It also revealed that the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, NCIS, yes, that NCIS, has also spied on Occupy protesters and reported back to other law enforcement agencies. Also, and this is an interesting one, the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, Virginia, had an operative surveilling Occupy and communicated the results of this intelligence gathering to the FBI. The Memphis Joint Terrorism Task Force listed Occupy Wall Street alongside the Aryan Nations as domestic terrorism threats. We also know that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the ATF, spied on Occupy and upon learning that the protests were entirely peaceful as planned, used this as a justification for continued surveillance, saying that this meant truly violent anarchist forces must be lurking and hiding somewhere and needed to be revealed. Literally, I could go on for another 15 minutes detailing the extent of surveillance performed by law enforcement and defense agencies on the Occupy movement as revealed by their own documents. Whatever happens with this Philadelphia case, it is clear that the federal government under Barack Obama viewed a mass peaceful protest movement against income inequality as a mortal threat. When you take a look at who makes most of the campaign contributions to people who run the government, you don't have to wonder why too much either. What is most noteworthy about the murder of Philando Castile by police is this statement by District Attorney for Ramsey County, Minnesota, John Choi. Choi said, quote, "No reasonable officer would have used deadly force under these circumstances," end quote. And the stranger part is that given the story told by prosecuting officials about what took place is that the officer, Geronimo Yanez, was charged with second-degree manslaughter, the lowest charge they could have gone with, and it carries up to 10 years in prison. This becomes more absurd when we look at the official narrative, which is based off a video that recorded the entire incident. To refresh people's memory, Castile was pulled over in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, which has a major reputation for pulling over black motorists for no reason. Yanez decided to stop Castile based on racial profiling. He decided that because Castile had a quote-unquote wide-set nose, he matched the description of a robbery suspect. Castile immediately pulled over his vehicle when requested, and when the officer approached the window, he informed him calmly that he did have a legally licensed handgun. Castile never reached for the gun. He never made any sudden movements or gestures or in any way acted angry, erratic, or irrational. Oh, and by the way, he was in the car with both his fiance and his daughter. And all of this interaction between Yanez and Castile happens in the course of a minute. After this 1 minute, where again, Castile did nothing, Yanez fired 7 shots at Castile from point blank range, then provides no emergency aid at all, keeping his gun drawn on the now highly traumatized passengers while Castile, a soon to be husband and already father to a daughter, bleeds out in the driver's seat. How on earth is this not murder? I have no idea. And on top of that, they didn't even arrest Yanez. Instead, he's actually hanging out at home until the trial. Here's the final test for President Obama, I think, on this issue. Well, maybe not be with so many people being killed by the cops, but it's a final test for President Obama. Will he direct the Justice Department to pursue this cop who clearly racially profiled someone, then executed them for no intelligible reason? Or will he just do another town hall where the police explain to black people how it's their responsibility to act in such a way that racist cops don't murder them? I may not be expecting much from President Trump on these issues, but let's just remember President Obama was often MIA as well. And those were today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And we're very happy to be continuing this conversation by being joined by Paul Hetznecker, who is a Philadelphia-based civil rights lawyer. Paul, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
No, of course. And so I wanted to know, I mean, what first led you to file this request in the first place regarding potential government spying on Occupy in Philadelphia?
Well, the best way to answer that question is really talk about the longstanding government surveillance that has existed in our country. We have a storied history of protecting and vindicating First Amendment rights as people express those rights through free speech, free assembly, and association. Unfortunately, we also have a long history and a very storied and dark history of government surveillance that chills those rights. And we can go back long before the COINTELPRO program of the FBI, but since that revelation, there were other government agencies that were it was revealed that they had targeted the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement during the 60s, had targeted congressmen and Supreme Court justice in terms of surveillance that had gone on for decades, in fact, for a long time in this country. And so out of that came the Church Committee hearings in the 1970s, which published significant reports on the extent to which government agencies had overreached and surveilled legitimate dissent in this country. Then we fast forward to 9/11, and then post 9/11, we've had expansive federal surveillance and government surveillance of political and private activities of U.S. residents, American citizens, and residents here in this country. And I think it's unfortunate that we have lost in our discussion of what's really important in our democracy. We have lost sight of the fact that transparency in government is a critical part of that. And FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, provides an important tool in that transparency because it essentially hopefully sheds light on the operations of government agencies that are operating in secret and delving into the private and political lives of U.S. residents. So having given that backdrop, I had represented a number of Occupy Philadelphia activists. In fact, there was a team of lawyers that had represented the activists, and there was four separate trials involving four separate mass arrests, and each one of those trials resulted in acquittals across the board. Everyone was found not guilty. And one of those trials was in conjunction with the eviction night. So November 29, 2011, when there was kind of a coordinated effort, various police departments throughout the country to get rid of the Occupy encampments, that also occurred in Philadelphia. And from the marches that ensued following that eviction in front of City Hall, there were arrests that night, a mass arrest of about 53 people. And out of that arrest, an eventual acquittal stemmed a lawsuit, and the lawsuit was filed seeking to vindicate both First and Fourth Amendment rights of those people that were arrested during eviction night. In conjunction with that, I filed the Freedom of Information Act requests on behalf of the Occupy Philly movement, and that was approximately 2 years ago.
Well, and I think that's an excellent point, and I think that there is at least some precedent that we know about out there on police agencies, quite a bit actually, surveilling the Occupy movement. We've certainly seen some on the movement for Black Lives. I mean, is it fair to say that, the government claims that, oh, we're not using any of our spying power against peaceful protesters or whatever, have sort of already been disproven?
I think there is. There's a body of evidence. There was certainly through FOIA in 2012 a revelation of a number of activities, a number of instances of FBI surveillance of the Occupy movement throughout the country, and that was revealed, like I said, approximately 4 years ago. And certainly the more recent revelations of government surveillance of the Black Lives Matter movement mirrors that. It's an extension of that. So we understand that, from public reports and good, intrepid reporters, that the Black Lives Matter movement had been surveilled by the FBI through aerial surveillance in Baltimore, ostensibly using allegedly facial identification recognition in an effort to identify who was protesting. And this goes back to a core point, which is the criminalization of dissent in this country. The idea of the dissenting voice is somehow equated with criminal is a very dangerous one, but it's not one that we haven't seen before throughout our history. We've seen cycles of this over and over again, but it's important to remember that all of us should be reclaiming our First Amendment rights with each new generation and with each new political movement, because the First Amendment has no meaning unless people are actively participating in objecting to the emergent corporate state, objecting to the policies that affect our lives and affect our freedom. And that essentially is what happens over and over again. The pushback is the government then starts to criminalize and look very carefully and treat those who are actively opposing a governmental policy as somehow requiring a level of surveillance that would equate criminal activity. And that's the danger here, and that's the threat to our democracy.
And, one of the things that I think is important for people to recognize, because I think some people say, well, they were monitoring them, but, maybe it wasn't that big of a deal or whatever. I mean, beyond that being, I think, sort of an underplaying of the issue. I mean, I wonder if you could just speak to the reality of the fact that, just having surveillance, period, has such a chilling effect that really in and of itself, beyond like arresting people or trying people, it really is a form of, I believe, sort of suppression of movements.
It absolutely is. I think that's a very good point. And as I can't really comment directly on the requests that I've made because I don't know what documents are out there yet, we have very little information. I'm very little was revealed by the FBI. So the pages that were revealed were redacted, heavily redacted. So I can't really know for sure what the documents are out there, but the request is essentially to initiate the checks and balances that have required and have been abdicated over the years since the Church Committee hearings. The whole purpose of congressional action in the 1970s was to put restraint on the expanding federal power of the executive branch to delve into and spy on private and political activities of Americans. And then we had the opportunity again, Congress had the opportunity several years ago after the revelations of the NSA spying that was revealed by the New York Times even before Snowden, and Congress did nothing except reinforce the executive power to do so. And here, what we need to remind ourselves of is that there is a third branch of government, and that's the judicial branch. And in this FOIA effort, it's a real effort to try to get judicial oversight of this expanding executive power. But you're absolutely right. Surveillance does chill First Amendment rights because in many ways it says to those who are out there demonstrating that somehow you need to be watched. And people don't need to be watched when they're expressing their viewpoint. They don't need to be surveilled. They don't need to have their phones monitored or their emails monitored. That doesn't need to happen. It's not a core part of our principles when we're trying to engage in this ever creative movement of our democracy, this constant changing, evolving system towards social justice. That thwarts that, because it essentially, the message to people is, don't participate because you may be considered a threat to government or to the corporate state. And that's a very dangerous precedent. Mm-hmm. And the Occupy movement was a perfect example of kind of combining the principles of challenging the emerging corporate state while at the same time basing that challenge on the very long story tradition of the First Amendment.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for that. We are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about some of the implications of Donald Trump's presidency on climate policy and what we can expect. And we're happy to be joined for that by Jason Swartz, who's a media officer at Greenpeace USA based out of New York City. Jason, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hi, Eugene. Nice to talk with you again.
And so I wanted to start with this issue. Many thousands have been out this week in solidarity with the folks at Standing Rock. And despite all the protests and the anger, Energy Transfer Partners still claiming that they are going to finish this pipeline on time and that they are actually not worried. So are the protests failing or are they lying?
They're wrong. And, you know, I know that this spot's going to mostly be about Donald Trump, but what these actions really show, and the timeline really shows, is that right now the ball is in President Obama's court and the court of the Army Corps of Engineers. So Trump has not spoken publicly about the Dakota Access Pipeline, and Energy Transfer Partners, of course, are up against a January 1st deadline to really make their investments and their investors' money count. So they're going to push as hard as they can. The real bulwark against this right now is going to be an Obama administration stand against the pipeline. I think that's really the aim right now of most of these national protests. On Tuesday, you saw a huge nationwide and actually global protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline that was mostly focused around really pushing the Army Corps of Engineers to be ambitious here, to do the right thing. And I think the message was heard, and we definitely expect some real proactive action by the Army Corps.
And what action? I mean, can they stop this, or do they can reroute it? They could reopen the process. I mean, what are the lines? Like, what can they do? Sort of for people who are angry about this, who I think I agree with you, would like to see some action right now. I mean, what are the things that the Army Corps of Engineers could actually do on this project?
Yeah, they could suspend the permits to continue to build, especially building under the Missouri River. The primary goal right now is to pause construction. Energy Transfer Partners is trying to build with abandon without going through a proper environmental impact assessment and a legitimate tribal consultation, which is really the primary issue that we're trying to bring to light. These are this pipeline is a violation of indigenous sovereignty and rights provided by treaties signed by the American government. So those need to be respected and were not in the original process. And so until those are really done, the pipeline is unlawful.
Well, and I think the other issue that I wonder about, it's a little bit more of a meta issue, but I think it's key and it connects the two to some degree. I mean, I've heard some talk about the Keystone XL pipeline being revived under Trump. And I wonder, just reflecting on that, I mean, how important are these sorts of direct action type movements like what we're seeing in Standing Rock moving forward over the next 2 years in terms of blocking these pipeline projects? Because, I mean, obviously people are saying, well, Trump is going to be for X, Trump is going to be for Y, but Obama wasn't necessarily out there waving the flag against many of these pipelines until people really stood up and did something and made it to some degree difficult business-wise to do it. So, I mean, looking at resistance, I mean, is it all doom and gloom just because Trump's in the White House, or does this issue at Standing Rock to some degree point to the fact that, you know, relying on movements perhaps could be a sign of hope?
Yeah, well, you know, I think one of the things that Standing Rock really shows is just how much the climate movement and other movements for justice in this country are deeply connected. When you have a pipeline, which is an actual piece of infrastructure that exists in a place that is going to affect negatively the environment of people in place, then you see all kinds of different other issues come around. I mean, right now, the movement against the Dakota Access Pipeline is focusing around indigenous sovereignty, as it should. You know, it's been indigenous-led, and it has been a really powerful show of solidarity across the country. Pipelines all across the country have impacts on people in other ways, whether it's through eminent domain or through the risks of spills and explosions everywhere. And the fact is, when you have something in place where people can organize around, perform direct action, engage in civil disobedience, engage in protest, make themselves seen and heard, it's that much more important. And I think that we have to recognize that, yeah, sure, maybe Trump represents a certain amount of danger for the climate movement at the federal level, but pipelines are local questions. You know, they're state questions, they're regional questions, and they provide an opportunity for people to do action that's not directed at a national government that has impact. So I think that fights like pipelines and plants and factories and sites of extraction are going to become even that much more important during a Trump presidency.
No, I think that's 100% true. I mean, the other thing that I thought about, too, is the coal industry. I mean, obviously, their big piece is, well, if we can't burn the coal in America, we'll just export all this coal around the world. But I think as what we've seen blocking the coal port in Oakland and other areas like that, that it's just going to be very difficult for them to do that. So, I mean, I think it's one of those, I don't know if it's a rare issue, but one of those issues where the local really does affect the national in a very direct, unremoved way. So I think that's a great point, and I'm glad you made it. You know, I wanted to ask something also in relationship to the Trump thing. Now, everyone's been talking about this guy, Myron Ebel, who is the transition guy around EPA, climate change denier, sort of a shocking thing. Beyond, and I want to get to this too, what sort of an EPA under someone like that could do from a policy standpoint. I also wonder if one big threat here is that having someone like this anywhere in the administration, head of the EPA or whatever, could turn some of these government agencies more into bully pulpits and big microphones for climate denial, which like they just haven't had since almost all scientists agree that that's nonsense, that now sort of the force of the government could amplify some of this research. And I wonder if that's sort of another thing to keep our eye on.
Yeah, definitely a concern. I mean, Myron Ebel seems to be waging his own kind of personal war against science and decency and has been doing it for a long time. And, you know, for those people who are hoping that a Trump presidency will sort of turn around miraculously and eventually his real colors will show and he'll be much more moderate, all you got to do is look at these kinds of personnel choices to recognize what his true intentions are. I mean, this is Myron Ebel. It would be a disaster for any kind of position at all related to the environment. This is a person who has sort of waged a historic war against the EPA. So I think that we have to be a lot more vigilant now than we ever have been. But I also think that Americans, by and large, believe that science is a thing. They believe that science is real, and they want to protect their children, and they want to protect their own future and their homes. And so I think that people will be able to recognize cockamamie stuff coming out of this government and will continue to organize around it. And certainly the climate movement is ready to, with plenty of opposition research and force and strength, along with, you know, the right of both science and morality to to fight them on this. And it's scary, but it's not, you know, it's something that we're all up for. It's a fight that we're all up for.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great point. And, you know, as I'm sure you know, but for our listeners, this guy Myron Ebo is also one of those guys working with the tobacco industry saying cigarettes were not that bad, which actually seems to be a theme these days with people who are climate deniers. They all seem to be people who were bitter enders on the cigarette piece, which, I don't know, to me that kind of just says it all about climate denial, given what we know about cigarettes and the way that played out.
Yeah, I mean, make no mistake, these guys are paid millionaire operatives by industry. These are not people who are waging this war because they have some kind of moral position. These are paid off people who've been making a lot of money sowing doubt among people across the world. So, I mean, this is an industry. This is not, you know, some guy who's doing it out of charity.
No, I think that's a great point. I mean, not to just rag on this guy, but I mean, he's not even a scientist. He's like a philosophy major in undergrad and political theory from LSE over in London. I mean, like, not that, you know, you can't know something about science, but it just sort of seems just so ridiculous that somehow that's like his credentials.
He's like a cartoon villain. I mean, this guy, really. I mean, he's just the kind of guy who, you know, his Competitive Enterprise Institute. You know, these guys are funded by the darkest of dark money, and the money that's not dark is literally coming from the petroleum and oil and gas industry, like Exxon. I mean, if anybody trusted Donald Trump's claim that he was going to reject the influence of lobbyists, Myron Ebo should be exhibit A that he was not being serious about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a very good point. And you know, one of the other issues I wanted to raise as well in the context of this is the issue of free trade deals. Because, you know, obviously I think TPP is dead, and I think people are rightfully celebrating that, although feel free to disagree. But, you know, whatever other deals Trump pursues with other countries, whether they be bilateral trade or whatever, are just clearly not going to be good on climate justice issues, workers' rights, or whatever. And so I just wonder, I mean, what are sort of the outlines that you think that we can start sort of pushing now in terms of an alternate vision? I mean, I think in a moment where quote unquote free trade is under such attack, and it seems like perhaps the first time in a long time to kind of redefine the paradigm by which America is engaging in the world, you know, to sort of go on the offensive and not just be opposed to trade deals. I mean, what are the things we should start sort of outlining and fighting for, do you think, to make sure that in this moment, perhaps a new vision can emerge?
I mean, there's so much there. And the place where I would definitely start is sort of taking on Trump on where he sort of begins on energy policy. He's really been speaking directly to co-producing communities that have been abandoned by the coal industry. And he claims that he's going to bring the coal industry back and those jobs back. The environmental movement, environmental regulation, is not the reason that coal markets are depressed globally. You know, and the world is waking up to the necessary transition to renewables. And the fact is, natural gas, although it's a bridge fuel that we certainly as an organization don't want to get behind too much, is the thing that is killing coal.
Mm.
You know, from mining to burning to social costs, coal is just a lot more expensive than natural gas. That's what killed coal. Not environmental regulation, not the environmental movement. Coal companies made bad decision after bad decision, including overestimating the market for U.S. coal in China, and huge institutional players like Peabody and Arch have gone bankrupt because of their own business practices. So like the first thing that we need to do is create and develop and invest in an alternate vision for coal producing regions of this country. And the progressive movement needs to align to support those communities and as they move to transition to a new economy. Coal is not coming back. Mm. It's not coming back because of its own bad decisions and because of its own lack of cost effectiveness. We don't need to return to their ways. We don't need to return to the ways that they've abandoned people there. We need to truly invest into those communities, not into corporate welfare for coal companies. So I think that real talk about just transition, really looking at how we can build out these economies and invest in real jobs in those communities is the first thing. I think that, you know, a second thing, and I think this is deeply related to that, is we need to really look at corporate welfare across the board for oil and gas. These are industries that are no longer working on their own. They're being utterly propped up by our government, and we need to move toward those energy sources that are, at this point, totally competitive with oil and gas and coal, yet not given the same sort of support by our government. And solar and wind are making huge strides. And I think that you're going to see a lot of state leadership on this now that we can expect not a lot of national leadership on it. You're going to see even more than you've already seen states leading the way, transitioning to cleaner energy sources. And those are some of the biggest economic engines of this country. We're talking about California. We're talking about Pennsylvania. We're talking about Massachusetts, Virginia, New York State, Washington, Pennsylvania. These are states that are going to lead that vision, and the rest of the country will inevitably follow.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think this could be, to some degree, a sleeper issue to divide the Republican caucus as well. I mean, I know in Iowa, the congressional delegation there, which is heavily Republican, states heavily Republican, some of them at least have weighed in positively in the past against their own colleagues for more support for wind power in particular, which is big out there, so that state-level leadership could potentially filter up nationally. I mean, everyone's saying the Republicans are going to do X and do Y, but I think the economics of it on the state level perhaps could create an interesting situation in Congress itself.
Yeah, no, definitely. We're really curious to see how that plays out too. It's sort of like bottom up state led transition for our energy economy. I mean, the market is already moving that way. I mean, Trump doesn't really need to do all that much. All he needs to do is sort of like maintain the status quo, and renewables are going to beat the oil and gas industry. But instead, he's talking about what he's talking about when he's talking about sort of all options on the table is really corporate welfare. It's propping up the dead men walking that are the coal and the oil and gas industry.
Mm-hmm. And I sort of buried the lead here, but I mean, how much of the Paris climate deal can Trump really roll back once he gets in there?
Yeah. You know, he can't cancel the Paris climate agreement. That is an agreement that has been come to by 190 sovereign states that are all extremely ambitious and are not in the business of denying climate change like the U.S. is. So I'm not worried that the Paris Climate Accord is going to go anywhere. It's not. And the fact is, like, actually pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord is pretty difficult and a pretty long bureaucratic process in and of itself. So what he can do instead is sort of not fund it. You know, he can pull our money out of the Green Climate Fund. He can not begin measures to implement here in the States. He can refuse to send representatives to future negotiations. He can do all of that stuff. But in the end, the world is moving forward. And if pulling the U.S. out of it only allows other countries to lead. So it's not something that he should do as a good businessman or a good diplomat.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps his business skills will prevail on him there. Well, you know, I think well, you know, I mean, I guess that's one of the things is like, who even knows what's going to happen? I mean, the general assumption is like, it's definitely going to be bad, but like, who knows what sort of like weird, bizarre areas where Trump will become. And, you know, he wants to be a realignment president. So perhaps with some Republicans coming out in favor of some of this stuff, as we were just talking about, that could be an interesting realignment. But either way, we're going to have to leave it there for today. But much more to say, and we will always continue to talk with folks from Greenpeace. That was Jason Swartz, who's a media officer there with Greenpeace in New York City. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. We're going to take a break. We're going to be back with more. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the aftermath of the Democrats shellacking on Election Day, November 8th, 2016, and their attempts to rebuild and broaden out their leadership. And we are joined by true experts on this topic, Sam Sachs, Sam Knight, who host Unanimous Dissent, which also airs here on Radio Sputnik, and also are with the District Sentinel. Go to districtsentinel.com. Excellent news co-op. You should put that in your favorites or whatever you do now, bookmarks. I don't even know if people do that anymore, but read it, districtsentinel.com. Gentlemen, thank you for joining the show.
Thanks for having us on. It's so chill in here. That music just puts you right in the mood.
Yeah. I am ready to discuss the issues. And thank you for having us, Eugene. It was a long trip. We didn't get covered for travel expenses, but whatever.
Yeah. Well, hey, what can I say? I don't control the money. I just work. But ultimately, there is a lot going on here with the Democrats, both in the Senate and on the DNC side. Let's start with the Senate. Now, the new leadership team is in place. Some interesting some interesting appointments, but I won't prejudge all of them quite yet. Sam Knight, I'll start with you. I mean, what do you think about the way the Democrats have aligned their forces here in the Senate caucus?
Well, what we focused on sort of today, there's sort of a dual track to this. First is the Senate Dems named a bunch of leadership positions, which are basically meaningless. They're cosmetic, director of outreach, so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. No one cares. Or no one should really care
which
about
that.
Which
went to Bernie and Tammy Baldwin and Joe Manchin. Yeah, I'm not sure what's
again,
outreach
it,
means,
well,
but yeah.
And in classic Dem style, they pick three. Had they picked just Bernie and Baldwin, by the way, I think that would have been fine.
Right.
Bernie, Baldwin, and Manchin, there appears to be no real coherent message there. In true Dem liberal fashion, they're trying to please everyone. And, you know, they didn't really get a clear message across. That said, What I found more interesting was the committee assignments that came out. Now, there are three major changes that happened, and this was really sparked by the retirement of Barbara Mikulski.
Mm.
Barbara Mikulski.
Senator from Maryland.
She is, yes, Senator from Maryland. She's retiring. She's gone in January. She has been the ranking Democrat on the Appropriations Committee. That's a very important committee. They decide where a lot of federal tax dollars are allocated. So what happened after that, or sort of how Dems have reacted to that, how it's played out, the ranking Dem on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy, he's leaving that post. He would prefer to be the ranking Dem on the Appropriations Committee. That's understandable. Now, what that triggered, now Senator Dianne Feinstein is taking Leahy's place on the Judiciary Committee. And this is kind of troubling. And I'll get back to who's taking Feinstein's place in a second, or maybe I'll hand it over to my colleague Sam to talk about that. But I just want to say the Judiciary Committee thing is rather disturbing. Leahy has been maybe not the best defender of civil liberties, but he's been pretty consistent and pretty solid mm-hmm. on civil liberties, which is important for the Judiciary Committee. Donald Trump's law and order agenda, to the extent that it's going through the Congress, is going through that committee. You could argue that maybe Feinstein is more effective on fighting judiciary nominations. She might be better if, sandbagging whatever SCOTUS Supreme Court nomination that Trump puts forth. But Feinstein is also super pro-security state.
Right.
She's been very hard on Snowden, huge cheerleader of the NSA. When Snowden's revelations about bulk phone collections came up, she responded in the news by saying it's called keeping America safe. Now, keep in mind, the Snowden revelations happened just weeks after the Boston Marathon bombing.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that work out? It obviously not very well. So bottom line is we're heading into this era of Donald Trump's scary, frightening law and order. And, you know, a consequence of Mikulski's retirement and the reshuffling that's going around is the Judiciary Committee is losing a good civil liberties advocate, and that's not something I really think we can afford right now.
Mm-hmm. Sam Sachs, I know Mark Warner, I believe, is taking over for Feinstein, but give me your thoughts about the shakeup.
Yeah, Mark Warner is now going to be the ranking member of the Intelligence Committee, and there was a brief moment in time today when we thought that maybe that job would go to Ron Wyden, one of the more aggressive senators toward the surveillance state, someone who would probably relish that role on the Intelligence Committee. Instead, Wyden is going to take a role in the Finance Committee where he'd been ranking member there as well. So look, the analogy, the way we analyzed all this on Unanimous Dissent earlier was the Democratic Party has some talent. You know, they've got people who can do really good work in certain areas.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that they have been placed on certain committees is not utilizing that talent at all. You've got someone like Ron Wyden. If you want to use Wyden's best
right.
talents for progressive causes, you put him on the Intelligence Committee, a place where he can take an oversight watchdog role over the intelligence community. You take someone like Leahy, you leave him on the Judiciary Committee because that's where he's been very strong, very, very effective. Wyden, he's not very good on finance. I mean, he's pro TPP. He does the bank's bidding to a certain extent. A lot of issues. He's far more conservative on that. So why not put someone like Sherrod Brown or Elizabeth Warren in those roles instead? We talked about it. Like you don't have Matthew Dellavedova and Kyrie Irving playing under the basket, trying to get rebounds, playing center and power forward. Mm. You keep them in the backcourt. This Democrats are not learning this lesson when they're organizing their leadership.
And I'm not as good as the sports analogies, but this is
that's basketball. That's not basketball. Really tall guys.
No, I know. I know Kyrie Irving is a guard for the Cleveland Cavaliers. Boom. Thank you. But you'll see why I had to preface that, because the only NFL reference I can think of is like it's putting Chad Ochocinco as punter.
Well, you know, Ochocinco, who was a big soccer or football player, perhaps, you know,
see,
good
again,
with
it's not the best analogy by me.
You know, he ate McDonald's good, every single day. But that's all. That was his whole thing, is how he had McDonald's every single day
Gorski.
For lunch. Exactly.
Well, Aaron Hernandez used to smoke blunts every day, didn't he?
And now he's in jail for
the
life.
Guy, but that's a whole
But he was
other...
good at football, right? Until he, like, killed,
until he killed
guy
someone.
Or possibly
maybe he
multiple
thought, like,
guys.
Well, hey, Ray Lewis did it one time. Either way, I mean, I wonder if the way we should parse this a little bit, Sam's, is that, you know, the big war on the DNC side is, well, are we going to have a more progressive chair, Keith Ellison, Congressional Progressive Caucus? And, you know, so on that side of things, they might move more progressive, but is that kind of a smokescreen if in the Senate it almost seems like they're standing down to some degree in some key committees? But
I don't think that's true. I think a lot of this is just sort of A, kind of no one really saw this coming, that whole thing. B, the Senate is a stickler for tradition and convention, and committee leaderships are usually doled out, and committee leader roles, excuse me, we're talking about vice chairmanships, ranking memberships. Those are usually doled out based on seniority. That said, we're in a bit of a major crisis right now. It might behoove the Dems to sort of light a fire under their behinds and appoint some of their more forward-thinking people. They're more populist. They're less corrupt people to important positions.
I could see progressives disappointed in someone like Senator Chuck Schumer being named the minority leader, being basically the head of Democrats in the Senate. And they should be. I mean, Schumer is from Wall Street, very close with the banks, pretty conservative on a lot of financial regulation issues.
He's gotten a little better, I will say this, over the years.
But ultimately, Schumer has been the guy in line to be the next leader behind him after Harry Reid to leave for like 6 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has been the guy in line. So like, if we had a problem with Chuck Schumer, the time to go after him would have been, you know, a couple of years ago, but it was a bit too late to try and unseat him. And Schumer came out in strong support of Keith Ellison to be DNC chair. I think that was a bit of like, hey, yeah, let's pay attention to getting progressives in power over at the DNC and maybe even at the House. Don't come after me. I'm all about Keith Ellison being there, and it might have paid off.
Mm-hmm. Sam.
Plus, one of Schumer's main roles is going to be as the Senate minority leader. One of his main roles is just going to be to speak on the Senate floor every morning. Every morning when the Senate convenes, they have morning business, which is basically each party leader getting out there, trying to influence the news cycle, trying to get their message across. There's usually very little news.
Well, it's also to own the Republicans, own the opposition party.
And you know, Schumer—
It's sort of like the Prime Minister
guy,
question
kind of,
time to some degree,
except
without any response
without
from
any
the
interaction
party.
Between— yeah. And I do think in a lot of ways, you know, the DNC chairmanship position is probably more important for short-term short-term gains than—
Why do you say that, though?
Because Ellison or whoever, excuse me, Ellison
they
hopefully—
power.
Yeah, they have power. Mm. They're more focused on 2018, right? Whoever is going to get that job, like— half of their job or all their job really is going to be 2018, 2018, 2018. And, you know, the last time we had a DNC chair who could be thought of at the time as progressive, Howard Dean, you know, 2006, right. Granted, there were other things going on, Bush administration collapsing all around him. For every other valid criticism of Howard Dean, and they're very valid criticisms, you know, 2006 was a pretty good year. Democrats taking back the House of Representatives, basically controlling both houses of Congress, setting themselves up for that huge when they could have had all the gains, when they had the White House, the Senate, and the House, and all they did was Romney care.
Yeah, well, and Sam Sachs, let me ask you that. I mean, how much of a lock do we think Ellison is? I mean, we've seen Howard Dean enter into the race. I saw some, like, anonymous quotations from some people who said, well, it seems like a knee-jerk reaction to have, like, a black Muslim from a blue state. Could there be – it seems like all the momentum is behind Ellison, but do you think there could – is it a lock for him, or is it more complicated?
I don't think it's a lock, unfortunately. I mean, given how powerful progressives are, you know, maybe not powerful, but emboldened or having the moral high ground that they have now since the loss of Hillary Clinton, people like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, people who want to move the party to the left, their endorsements are strong. They should carry a lot of weight, and I think they do. But you're already seeing more Democratic establishment entities, apparatuses coming out against Ellison. I was watching MSNBC and Chuck Todd's show, and on there you get the roundtable of political pundits and experts, and they're throwing around people like Tom Vilsack as who should lead the DNC. Like, you know, Tom Vilsack would really raise a lot of money in the Rust Belt and pull a lot of people into the party. And it's like, you guys are just not getting it. The message of what's
the guy who helped
here.
Launch Breitbart into the big sphere with the Shirley Sherrod thing. I'd never even heard of Andrew Breitbart until then.
I forgot Vilsack is the guy that canned what's her
Shirley
name?
Shirley Sherrod. Yeah. And the White House without even reading the thanks in a note and said, "Hey, great job, Tom."
And plus, if you're gonna think of an Iowa politician who's past his prime for the Dems. Tom Harkin, longtime senator, progressive, who held on to that seat in Iowa for years and years and years, friend of labor. When he left the Senate in 2014, Sherrod Brown gave a very emotional tribute to him. Yeah, why not him?
And probably the most dishonest line of attack we're seeing against Ellison is this idea that, we've uncovered these DNC rules that say the position needs to be a full-time job so that a member of Congress can't obviously be the DNC chair because they also have this other job. No one dusted off this old rule book when Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's also a member of Congress, was chairing the DNC.
I also believe it's in the DNC rules. I could be mistaken, but I believe it's also in the DNC rules to remain neutral during a primary. That didn't happen. I don't see people on MSNBC calling for everyone in the building to be thrown out, as they should. But I also want to say it's more than just a moral high ground, Sam, as you said. It's a strategic high ground, right? I mean, Democrats' main argument, their main draw for electoral strategy is we're not Republicans. We can win, you know, unite behind us, whatever. We're not perfect. They tried that last week and they got bullied. Okay. Like maybe that, I mean, a lot of that probably has to do with Hillary Clinton herself being an awful candidate. But at some point, you know, maybe the establishment figures should step back and say, hey, Keith Ellison was the first person in Congress to come out and support Bernie Sanders.
He also predicted Trump.
He did predict
Trump.
He's
actually looking pretty good.
He's looking pretty good as a guy who understands the moment. Sorry.
No. I think it's totally fine. It just made me wonder if like one takeaway from this election was how unbelievably insular Hillary Clinton's advisors were. I mean, I remember Debbie Stabenow was like, I was trying to tell the, not Debbie Stabenow, Debbie Dingell. It was just like, I was trying to tell them for like months that we were losing in Michigan and we needed to do something and nobody listened to me. I mean, it's pretty crazy looking at the WikiLeaks and seeing, you know, high level important strategists like you got to Stan Greenberg. I mean, all these people throwing it out there and just Robbie Mook and his people
and
nothing.
And Karen Finney was just on CNN on Wednesday and she was asked to take, you know, what went wrong with the Clinton campaign. And the only thing she could think of doing was blaming, quote unquote, Bernie bros. I mean, how out of touch can you be? Karen Finney should never work in this town again. She should never work in politics again after that awful performance. How could you even say, how could you even vie for a job when you have your name, when you have the Hillary campaign, like a scarlet letter on your resume? You know, it's unbelievable. This was the most disastrous major campaign in modern history, and you have its major figures still out there pointing the finger elsewhere. It just boggles the
blaming
mind.
Blaming Bernie bros, I've heard them blame internalized misogyny on why she was not able to get
win over
any,
white women.
Yeah, why she wasn't able to collect a higher percentage of white women than Barack Obama basically was able to collect. And of course, there's zero evidence to prove that. I mean, not to say that misogyny isn't a powerful force and sexism isn't a powerful force, but let's face it, They had an open layup. They missed it. It was a terribly run campaign. And all the evidence that's come out since proves that, whether it was their vaunted voter operation, voter get out the vote operation, which we now know was targeting Trump voters and wasn't targeted at the right areas to win the states they needed to win, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Yeah, it's all a disaster.
Well, a real question, I guess, speaking of people never working, does Robbie Mook ever work again in this town?
I mean, people probably fail up in this town.
Nor Brian. Well, I hope not. I hope we're coming around on that.
Shout out Bob Trump.
I also hope that Brian Fallon never works in this town again. And if you've been following politics in D.C. for a while, you know that Brian Fallon, before he joined the disastrous Clinton campaign, he was a spokesperson for the Justice Department defending these awful precedents that Trump is going to take from the Obama administration and use to crack down on civil liberties. Espionage Act, indictments for journalist sources, et cetera, everything that Brian Fallon defended, Trump can now take the ball and run with that. Well, and thank you, Brian. Thank you very much, buddy.
Well, and thank you to Sam Sachs and Sam Knight of Unanimous Dissent, as well as DistrictSentinel.com for joining us. That's going to do it here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.